WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neurologist Oliver Sacks studies disorders of the brain to understand more about how the human brain works and what makes us human. His patients have disorders like Tourette syndrome, autism, and amnesia. He's discovered that neurological problems often have the paradoxical role of bringing out latent creative powers. He writes, the study of disease demands the study of identity, the inner worlds that patients under the spur of illness create. Dr. Sacks is best known for his books that describe those inner worlds through case studies. Those books are The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and Awakenings, which was adapted into a film starring Robin Williams as Dr. Sacks. In his new book, An Anthropologist on Mars, Dr. Sacks writes about a patient who's an artist who became colorblind after an auto accident. Dr. Sacks calls him Jonathan I.
He was driving to a studio the day after the accident, and everything looked gray and bleached. Although he knew that it was a bright, sunny day, and when he got there, his paintings, which were brilliantly colored, he was an abstract expressionist who was really famous for his use of color, were all sort of drained of color and in a sense of meaning and feeling for him. And he was aghast. And he went home, and his wife was a sort of an animated gray statue, as he described it. And he himself was gray, and the notion of gray flesh, touching gray flesh, sort of horrified him. And memory and imagination didn't help, as happens in this sort of situation when the color-constructing parts of the brain are knocked out. You not only lose the ability to perceive color, but to imagine it or remember it. Sort of the neural idea of color is deleted. And this was a terrible time for him at first, because he found himself in a very ugly, impoverished world, and one which was sort of drained of meaning.
You know what I found? That losing his sense of color affected every aspect of his life. It affected what he wanted to eat. You say he only wanted to eat black and white foods like yogurt or rice or black olives.
Right. Well, anything else just looked terribly wrong for him. And it's his dog looked terribly wrong. And he wanted to get a black and white dog.
I think what helped me get a sense of what he was going through was a painting of his that you reproduce in the book. And it's a still life of apples, oranges, bananas, but it's all in blacks and grays, with the exception of one orange that has its true color in the center of the painting. And the black banana is, it's grotesque, it's nauseating.
Well, this was certainly how he found it. These fruits which he made were actually part of a whole gray universe which he made in his studio. It was a sort of a room with a banqueting table and a dinner laid out, and to try and show us what it was like. One of the things which had vexed him was people said, well, so you don't see color, no big deal, what the hell, you know. And it was in a way to try and convey the enormity of it that these sort of gruesome artifacts were produced.
What's so surprising about this story is that slowly his experience was redefined. What started off being really grotesque and nauseating to him became more natural.
Indeed, this was very remarkable. When he came to see me, I first sort of tried to define the damage as much as I could, and it was clear that there were two small areas in the back of the brain, in the visual cortex, which had been knocked out, areas which are sometimes called the color-constructing areas. I didn't know whether they would ever recover, and I hoped he might sort of start to feel less horrified by this world. But as you say, in fact, the opposite happened, and gradually what had been so horrible took on a sort of beauty for him, and he reconstituted his world, or his world reconstituted itself in black and white, but again with the meaning and the feeling and the coherence and the artistic possibilities restored to it. And he started painting again, and people remarked on, on the extraordinary power of this new black and white art. Very few of them knew that there'd been a neurological accident behind it. But it's this moving, losing one world, but then being able to recreate the world in oneself and in other terms, which was so striking with him, and in a sense, I suppose, becomes one of the themes of the book.
When you stopped seeing him, where did you leave things with him in terms of your diagnosis and prognosis?
Well, in terms of the diagnosis, he had knocked out these two small areas which are called V4 in the brain, probably from a vascular accident, and I doubted if there would be any recovery. By that time, he had been launched on his art and again on his life, and didn't seem to be repining too much and no longer seemed to be yearning too much for colour. In the early days, he had, he would glare at oranges and trying to restore them to their, in imagination, to their proper colour. And now he seemed very much at home and even, I think, felt that he was in a rather privileged world of subtle tone and texture, and that the rest of us were sort of subject to sort of a chromatic distractedness. There was one point when a colleague of mine thought of a way by which it might have been possible to reprogram other parts of the brain to construct colour. And at that point, he said, I would have loved you if you could have done this earlier. But now, he said, I don't want it anymore. My world is complete without colour.
My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He has a new book called An Anthropologist on Mars. There's a story that's a really, really fascinating counterpart to the story of the artist who was colorblind. And this is the story of a man who was blind for 45 years, and then his sight was restored. And he had incredible difficulties adapting to having his sight.
Yes, this was Virgil. And I first learned of him. Many of the stories, cases here, have started with a letter or a phone call, quite out of the blue. And here the phone call was saying, this man, blind since infancy, had surgery and his sight was restored, and now he sees everything, but he recognizes nothing. And hell, what's going on?
Well, what was going on? Is that typical that if somebody has a sense restored or given to them for the first time in their life, that they can't make anything coherent out of it?
Well, I think this is typical, and I think perhaps it might have been anticipated, but this is a very rare situation. There have really been no more than perhaps 15 or 20 such cases described since the early 18th century, although interestingly, precisely this was described in 1728 in a blind boy from whom the cataracts were couched. But the immediate notion, and the notion you have in the Bible and in fairy stories, is that vision will be restored. And it was thought here that Virgil would have the operation. It might fail completely, but it might work, and he would say, hallelujah, I can see again. And what happened wasn't at all like that. When the bandages were unwound, he saw a blur of movement and colour, which was chaotic, which made no sense. And it was only when his surgeon spoke that he thought to himself, voices come from faces. That blur must be a face. But it wasn't a coherent percept for him. He had no visual concept of a face. And this was his introduction, really, to a world of deep chaos in some ways, and the chaos of a man and a brain which hadn't learnt to see, which didn't know how to deal with this new input from the eyes.
So instead of the fairy tale happy ending where he shouts, hallelujah, my sight is restored, was he sorry that he had his sight restored?
Well, it was complex and mixed, because there were also some there were some positive experiences. He was in fact delighted by movement and by colour, and he started to recognise various things. And it was certainly an adventure for him, but it was also a terrible challenge and stress, and one which I think was too much for him. And so increasingly he would often close his eyes or turn off the light and long for this secure world of touch and the other senses in which he felt at home.
This story has a very unusual twist to it. He ended up losing his sight again. What happened?
Well, in a way which I think might have was sort of a bit uncanny, and it happened soon, you know, at a time when he seemed to be turning a corner and really beginning to get used to the world of sight. He developed a bad pneumonia and almost died. This knocked out the respiratory center in his brain, and so the levels of oxygen in his blood fell very low. When they fell low, he would become completely blind again, and then he would recover some sight as the levels went up. But then, with this situation continuing, what sight he had and the visual world which he had achieved sort of disappeared again, and he once again became blind and completely blind, and in a way blinder than he had ever been before, because his retina in effect got destroyed. And what exactly happened, I don't know, but I would suspect that these very abnormal blood gases must have played a part. It was an uncanny twist, but one which his wife and doctor, some people saw with horror. He himself, I think, was not entirely horrified, and it may have sort of released him from an impossible fight. I have to say that since then he has lost a good deal of weight, and he is no longer on oxygen, and I'm told there is some sight again, and I have to see him, and there may be a postscript to this piece sooner or later.
Yeah, you also write that disorders and disease can play a paradoxical role by bringing out latent powers and creative potential. I guess that relates in a way to Jonathan Eye, the artist who became colorblind and started to work with that and do paintings that were acclaimed.
Yes, well, his sort of creative powers were there, but they were able to sort of flow into a new channel. But sometimes I think that an affliction alone can bring out something quite unexpected. I see this in many different ways. Something I didn't describe in the book, but it just comes into my mind. I have a patient, a very nice woman, who became quadriplegic in an accident. But now every morning she is able to look at the New York, the Times crossword, to consign the entire crossword to memory and then solve it mentally in the course of the day. She said she could never have done this before she became ill, but this sort of strange power just came to her.
My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. His new book of case studies is called An Anthropologist on Mars. Dr. Sacks grew up in a medical family. Both of his parents were doctors. Why did you choose neurology as your area of specialization?
I think it was partly in the family conversation. Both parents had trained in neurology, although neither of them stayed in neurology. I think partly when I was very young, I used to have severe blinding migraines. Indeed, I confess I have one at the moment.
Do you really?
Well, it's a mild one. But then, as it were, part of a vision to the left, usually, or half the visual field would disappear, or sometimes it might be drained of colour, as happened with Jonathan Eye. So I think I got a very early sense that the world was slightly was only given to one by courtesy of the brain. And, but this, you know, people talk about the three-pound universe and in the head. You know, I've loved and still love all the other sciences, and I'm happy to revert to them and sort of walk in the botanical garden and botanize. But finally, the brain is infinitely more than any leaf or kidney. It's the most complex object in the universe, and this object which makes possible a subject, and our subjective life of feeling and mind and religious strivings and sensibility, and it's the most enormous, wonderful mystery. And I think it was clear to me from the age of 13 or 14 that that's probably what I wanted to look at.
When you have a migraine like you do now, do you have any appetite for discussing your work or doing your work? How much are you disabled by the pain and other side effects of the migraine?
It was bad about an hour ago, but it's not bad now. Amongst other things, I'm partly fascinated by migraines, and I think having migraines myself was one of the things which incited me to my own first book, which was on migraine. So there's some part of me which always sort of, you know, uses it to investigate things, but I think this migraine is also saying to me, you've been up and doing one thing and another since 5 this morning, and really almost nonstop for 3 days, and you better take it easy for. I'm partly conscious of the migraine as a sort of strategy of the organism.
Tell me what else you've learned from your own migraines. I hope it's not making the pain worse to dwell on this.
No.
But, we all get headaches, some of us worse than others. And I just find when I have a headache, it's difficult to concentrate. It's difficult to really enjoy life. Sometimes I feel like, well, gee, my whole worldview is dependent on hormones and neurological pathways. Do I have a headache? You know, what are my hormones like today? And you feel like, shouldn't I be able to transcend this? You know, haven't I been like alive long enough that I could just transcend all that and be in a good mood no matter what? Yeah, go ahead.
For example, Freud had bad migraines. And he spoke of some of the difficulties that he would have difficulty remembering proper names in migraines and sometimes complex actions. But he felt he could rise above it, and it wouldn't stop him from doing anything. He said the same about the colds and influenzas he got, and he said the same about the terrible cancer of the jaw, which tormented him in the last 17 years or so of his life. I mean, one does rise above these things all the while, and yet the other side of this is that perhaps the imagination is limited by what's going on with the body. For example, and I describe this in a leg to stand on, in my autobiographical book about being a patient myself, when the nerve supply to and from one of my legs was really quite badly damaged in an accident, and I was getting no information about the leg, then the leg appeared to me to be not mine. It was not only paralyzed and senseless, it was alien. It was just a thing. The imagination could not triumph over this. Again, later when I had a spinal, and I think this is the experience of everyone who has a spinal anesthetic, you feel that you terminate in the middle. And what lies below this sort of forked object of so-called hips and legs is not yours and not anything. And you cannot imagine it back. Again, with Jonathan Eye, the colorblind painter, he thought that his will and imagination and expertise as an artist could just make color. He can't. There's a wonderful poem of D.H. Lawrence in which he says, God can't imagine red. And just one way and another, I'm sort of, in a way, divided between the submission of the imagination to the organic, and it's transcending the organic in other ways.
Well, Oliver Sacks, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Neurologist Oliver Sacks, his new book is called An Anthropologist on Mars.